This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil.
We'll be brave. Gotta be brave. I'll be brave in a new world. I'll be brave. Brave. Brave in a new world.
That's one of the voices from Brave in a New World, the newest production from Judy Dworin Performance Project. It presents the stories of women who reentered society after serving time in York Correctional Institution, the only state prison for female offenders. Four ex-inmates join the professional ensemble of the Judy Dworin Performance Project. And some of those former inmates are in studio with us, as well as Judy Dworin. Dworin, welcome to Where We Live, Judy.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you're founder and executive and artistic director of the Performance Project.
Yes, I am.
Also in studio with us is Robin Cullen, a performer in Brave in a New World. She's a board member for the Judy Dworin Performance Project, a consultant, a group facilitator, and artist. Robin, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Lisa Srams, performer in Brave in a New World, also an artist and grandmother. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'll start with you, Judy. We know, if we've been in Hartford for some time, that you've been working in theater for a long time, including residency work at York Correctional Institution. Mm-hmm. For our listeners who don't know, that is the state women's prison in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about what brought you there.
Well, I don't think I expected particularly to work in a women's prison, but a chance encounter with Wally Lamb, who was doing a writing program there, and he said, "Have you ever thought about working in a women's prison?" And we work with a lot of underserved populations, and also we're very interested in working with people that don't have a voice or haven't been heard and giving them a voice. And so it seemed like an interesting idea. And what seemed like an interesting idea became a really transformative one for me.
So how long have you been doing it? 2005?
Yes. So we're on our 12th year.
Tell us about this newest production.
Brave in a New World is a sequel to a piece that we did in 2014, In My Shoes, when we started working and trying to integrate women who had been released from York, who had been part of our programs, also who were working in resettlement program with Community Partners in Action in the community, to continue that arts engagement with us and with the professional ensemble. So we did a piece called In My Shoes, which was really bringing the voices of women both inside prison and who were out together and out to the general public. And it felt like there was more to say. There's lots more to say, more than just two pieces. And so Brave in a New World really looks at what it's like to come home from prison. Reentry is a big topic right now. It's something that we think about a lot. And so it's a focus really on what it is like to come home, what it's like to be there, but then what it's like to come home. And it juxtaposes that story with the voices of children who have to deal with the separation from their parent when their parent is in prison, because we work with those kids in the community a lot.
Let's shift to some of the performers who are in studio with us again, Robin and Lisa. Robin, tell me a little bit about your backstory and how you got to know Judy.
I did not meet Judy until after my time at York. It was the first production that Judy had done, bringing the work to the stage out in the general public, and I was invited because of my work with Wally Lamb to do the talkbacks with the audience. They were looking for someone who had been at York, and so I did talkbacks with the audience to time in the very first production and have been ever since, because I can't not do this after what my experience has been.
Tell me about what led you to York. What was your time like there?
My time. Well, what I've seen is many people end up at York because of past trauma turning into a circumstance that manifests as crime, and then they become incarcerated. My story is probably a little bit different because my choices were made in adult life, and it was a bad choice to drink and drive. And I ended up taking a life, which landed me at York. But the big story is that it was not what I ever expected. I had an idea of what prison might be, but I never really thought about it because it didn't come into my world. And my eyes were wide open to so many social issues, that the trauma behind the crime, the trauma behind the trouble that we have in families and communities in our society. And so, ultimately I got involved with Wally Lamb and that, watching women overcome by sharing their stories and finding out they're not alone. And much of that is what we still do with this work, with the women at York, with bringing this to the public, because we are good people who made bad choices, and it's not about it's not about anything other than that. And healing is what we're looking for as the end result, and we can't heal people through punishment. You know, my healing happened because of the groups that I attended, because of the work with Judy, because of the community support. I wasn't punished well. You know, it's been proven time and time again that community support is really an important piece, and bringing this work outside the prison and allowing women who've been incarcerated to gather on the outside and be supported the same way that we found community inside. And so this next step, working on the outside, also keeps us connected, because the reentry piece is where people often fall into the big dark hole because there isn't support.
And we're going to talk more about that support that's available within prison and then without later in the show. I wanted to turn to Lisa Srams. Tell me about what led you to York and what was it like for you there?
Well, what led me to York is I made a couple of mistakes when I was younger, made a couple of bad choices, but I used those choices and those experiences because I met Judy in 2008, and I was incarcerated, and I started off as her roadie and setting up for her. And then from there, we started speaking, and she actually asked me to join, which I was very honored to join, because the healing process that you go through, writing, dancing, and the singing, it's something that you don't get inside the prison, besides inside the mental health unit with different groups. And the choices that you do to make sure that you want to heal is the point. You have to accept the fact that you have to face a lot of things that have happened to you, that you have been involved in, the trauma. And until you can really face that, you cannot actually heal, and you cannot move forward in your life. And for me, it was a big step for me, because using Judy's program, amongst other programs that started coming in, if we didn't have the outside to come inside and who weren't afraid to come inside, then a lot of us would not heal and be where we are today. And as far as York, I had went in when I was 19 for a murder charge, which Connecticut does not have a self-defense law. So therefore, I was given 10 years. And then I was released, and I ended up right back in 2008 for a hindering a prosecution with a family situation. So for me, the choices that I made before entering York on my last bid was, I've always put someone else in front of me, and I had to learn to put myself first. And now that I have done that, I have been able to be a better person, a better mother, a better friend, and make choices and bring awareness to people, because the things that everybody makes a mistake. It's not the mistake that's the problem. It's what you do after the mistake. Because if you continue to go left when you should be going right, it's not a good thing, you know, and the support that I have, because there's a lot of people that I actually grew up with that actually worked in a facility, and they took time out to avoid some of the rules and still reach out and, you know, give that support. And when you have a support system, because not only did you have a support system with the volunteers coming in, you had a support system. There's a family within a family inside the prison. You create your family background. So therefore, a lot of close-knit people help you get through whatever you got to get through. And that right there is power alone.
So both you and Robin were mentioning how Judy's residency and the writing workshops helped you heal. But meanwhile, while you're trying to find support inside, life is going on outside. Let's hear a clip from the show Brave in a New World. This is Lisa, again, Lisa Srams, who spent some time at York and is one of the performers in Brave in a New World. This is you talking about learning that you're going to be a grandmother.
I lie in my bed and I stare at the ultrasound picture on my wall, and all I can think, see, dream, and imagine is that I'm going to be your grandmother, and I'll make it home for the birth. The excitement has me up tonight. The pure joy of holding this child, my grandchild, is a growing amazement since I opened my mail today. God has given me a second chance. A second chance to right my wrongs, mistakes, and failures through my son's unborn child. To have those little...
Tell us about that excerpt and how you came to the point where you wanted to share that in this performance.
Well, like I said, writing with Judy, you know, you learn to heal. And I had made so many mistakes in my son's life, not being there physically, but trying to be there mentally and emotionally. It's kind of difficult when you're incarcerated. And, you know, he had a lot of anger. So we got to a point where we could actually deal with all of that. And we did. And, you know, I was talking to him. He was like, you know, I'd called one day. Actually, I think it was after a Judy rehearsal. And he was like, Ma, I got something to tell you, but don't get mad. And I'm like, okay. And then when he kept going into that, I'm like, okay, what is it? Who's pregnant? And there it was. And then I actually spoke to his girlfriend. And then they told me, and I was like, well, I'm excited. And then as soon as I went in my room, because I hadn't been in there, my mail was on the ground. So when I opened it, the ultrasound picture fell out. So it's very exciting because, like I said, in the piece, you know, I was given a second chance. So everything that I went wrong with my son, I'm doing right with my granddaughter. And I tell you one thing, being a grandmother is the deepest, most gratifying, exciting. The love is just amazing when it comes to your grandchild. I mean, it is for your child, but it's even deeper when it comes to your grandchild. And I never really understood that because a lot of people used to say, you don't understand, wait, just wait. And now I see, and now I know.
That's Lisa Strams, a performer in Brave in a New World. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're taking a look at this performance that will be premiering at the Greater Hartford Academy of the Arts next week. It's a performance, the latest project from the Judy Dworin Performance Project. If you've experienced prison, if you have a loved one who is in prison, we'd like to hear your story. 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Judy, Brave in a New World, again, is showcasing the stories of former inmates, not only their experience inside, but then the transition outside. And you had mentioned earlier, with all the attention on Governor Malloy's Second Chance Society initiatives, the idea that our criminal justice system needs reformed, that people, when they make a bad decision, they do their time, they come out, they deserve that second chance. When we had a conversation a few weeks ago, you mentioned that there's another population, an invisible population that's affected by incarceration, and that's the voices, the children. Mm-hmm. This piece includes the voices of children, right. Children with incarcerated parents. Tell us about your decision to include that, and how did you find these children, and how did you get them to want to communicate about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, we found the children really through the work that we began with the women at York and seeing the families' performances and seeing what it meant to the families to see their moms, sisters, grandmothers perform. And we realized, you know, there's this population here, the families and the kids, that are largely unaddressed and are very invisible. So we started to do an outreach we have in-school programs in the Hartford Public Schools as well as after-school programs that reach out to children who have parents in prison. Kids carry it around as a very tightly held secret, and they don't have a space to really open up and discuss it and share it. So we found in these groups that there was almost a familial bonding that happened amongst the kids because there was such a sense of relief that everybody in the room knew exactly what it was, and they didn't have to hide it. They could share it. They could do arts activities. They could talk about what it was like as well as what other things were like. So we don't always talk about it. Every week we don't say, well, what's happening with your feelings about having your parent? But really, as they're ready to, they start to share. And we saw and have seen and are seeing really big behavioral changes. And it's very, very beautiful work. So it felt to me like that story really needed to counterpoint this one of coming home because I think they are a population that isn't heard. And so it was thinking of a way to bring their voices in, but also protect their anonymity. They're part of the Sound Score. We hear their wonderful voices. And we also, the piece starts out with the women as children and as innocents. And then that childhood role gets taken by the kids who actually are kids and who are all experiencing this and what their bravery is in standing up to it.
So we're going to hear some of those voices of the children that are, their voices are featured in Brave in a New World.
A wonderful dream that went through my dream catcher is that mommy came out of jail.
This building that I am drawing is solid.
We went to Chuck E. Cheese.
I have to figure out how to get through it.
Then we sang a rhythm.
Day by day, step by step, I climbed to reach the top.
Then we went to the beach and had fun as a family.
The top is where mommy gets out of jail and we will be together again.
So it's not easy to hear though. These are actual children. These aren't children, you know, reading the words of children that have incarcerated parents. These are the actual children talking about their feelings with an incarcerated parent.
Yeah, the two children that you just heard wrote the words that they say. Yeah. And they've actually been with us in our group for a long time. Many of the children that we've seen over years. We don't just see them for a short time and then it's done. It's a long-term process. Yeah,
it's interesting because we often hear about the stigma. You know, again, two women here who've had experienced prison and how society views you, even if after you've done the time. But thinking about how children also feel that stigma. Mm-hmm. You know, is there, from your work at York, is there more being done within our school systems to reach out to these children? Or is this something that, you know, luckily these children were able to find this support within this writing group?
It's more the latter. It's more the luckily, because very often the kids aren't identified. It's not necessarily in their record that they're dad or mom is in prison. And so I think sometimes teachers find out about it or whatever, but there isn't any concerted effort to say this is a track of kids that really we need to watch for this. And there is a lot of stigma, and there can be bullying, and there can be a sense of shame, there can be a sense of guilt, anger, abandonment, and all those things need to be processed in healthy ways. And very often if they're not looked at, then they aren't.
I want to turn back to Lisa. I mean, what's your take? What do you think needs to happen to help children who have incarcerated parents?
Well, another Judy program, literally, and not just in a particular area, but it needs to not only be statewide, it needs to be nationwide, because there are so many parents that are incarcerated and the children are forgot about. They're not addressed. They have issues. There's counseling that needs to happen. There's reunification that needs to happen. And personally, my feelings with DCF, they're not like they used to be. They're not as involved as they should be, because if they were, I mean, I really just feel like a lot of the issues that the children go through in dealing with their parents being incarcerated, as well as the schools. The schools do need to have a section where, you know, they're aware of a parent being gone. They could be being raised by their aunt, but the home may not be as safe or as comfortable for that child because they miss their parents. And no one really likes talking about your parents in jail. They don't really like to say that. There was a time where someone told my son I was in college. I said, don't ever do that, because then the lies begin and that pain develops. And that shouldn't happen, because when it starts to develop, you don't know what happens from there. And that's the problem. Once the pain begins, the hurt is already there, so the pain begins, and then comes the anger, comes the whatever the case may be. But after-school programs, I know, do help. But like I said, I think it really needs to be addressed a little bit more within the school system and even within the home, just learning not to lie to the child.
Can you talk about your relationship with your son while you were in prison? And then
it was rocky. I mean, the first time I went in, my son was 2.5. So in the beginning, he really didn't understand anything that was going on. And like I said, they tried to say, you know, she's here, she's there. Don't do that. For me, it was don't do that, because growing up myself, I was lied to too much in my life by my parents, that I would never inflict that on my child. And a lot of things that I didn't want inflicted on my child that had happened to me did actually happen, but it wasn't by choice. Things just ended up, that's the way it was. So for me, it was difficult in the beginning, but once my son started to really understand and get a grasp on this is where I am and I'm not coming home for a little while, it was difficult for him. You know, he developed a lot of anger issues and he didn't know where to put that misplaced anger. So he acted out. It was a lot of fights. It was a lot of screaming, tantrums. You know, there was a couple of times where they actually called me in the prison from where he was to tell him to take meds. And I mean, that's another thing. You really don't want your child on meds, but then what do you do?
Judy, did you want to add?
I just wanted to say that one of the things that has been wonderful in our work in the schools is our partnership with social workers, and that there have been amazing social workers in the schools and also families in crisis social workers working with us in the after-school program. And community partners in action resettlement with working with women that are released. So it's a wonderful arts partnership with social work that I think is really the is key.
And we're going to hear from one of those social workers working within the Department of Correction in just a little bit. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking to women who are sharing stories of their time in prison and their experiences once they got out. It's a new production from Judy Dworin Performance Project called Brave in a New World. Again, it's premiering next week in Hartford. We'll have details on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. The stories focus on confinement and separation, but also the transition ex-offenders make when they return to their communities. Their stories are told through spoken word, song, and dance to show that life doesn't necessarily get easier just because they're now free from prison. I wanted to turn back to Robin Cullen. Let's talk about some of the challenges you faced. In the performance, you talk about coming home from prison and the emotions associated with that experience. Let's hear this clip.
As we crest the hill, I see the house I grew up in on the left. What the heck? There's a huge banner hanging on the house. As I read it, I feel completely on fire by the time I reach the exclamation point. It says, "Welcome home, Robin." My red-faced, breathless stare looks like anger, but this time, red is the color of shame. I'm not coming home from college or the military. I know they missed me, but for God's sake, I was in prison.
You talk about feeling shame when you were coming home. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, I mean, from way back before coming home, the shame that goes with, you know, my behavior and finding, you know, looking in self-reflection, looking back, how did I get here? And what, you know, what was that process for me? And looking back and realizing that my choices, you know, the outcome of hurting so many people comes back on my choices. And, you know, then I start to understand things behind that. And it becomes, looking back at family history, it becomes, you know, mental health, addiction, alcoholism, all these things that bring so much shame because there was a time where all of these things weren't talked about or shared, and what goes on in this house stays in this house. And so coming out from under that and being, you know, being part of that process, recognizing that, you know, that there are things that don't feel normal outside of our home. And then, you know, in my dysfunctional family, which, you know, is pretty common, but these things that we don't talk about so we don't feel part of or connected. And then to have, you know, to have been gone so long, a few years, come home and it's like a celebration. I don't, you know, there was the part of me where I kind of didn't want anyone to know. You know, and now there's this huge sign on the house and like, wow. But then I look at it from the perspective of my family, because when someone is incarcerated, their entire family, you know, the children, the family, it ripples out community. You know, it's a social issue. It's not just about the person who commits the crime. And so that was like all up in my face coming up the hill. I was like, oh, my God, you know, there's just so many emotions that go with it. Of course, I was celebrating my freedom, but I also knew that once I get out of prison, I still have the guilt and the shame and the, you know, the long road ahead to carry this with me and, you know, try to figure out how I'm going to navigate through my life. Because when the prison sentence ends, the, you know, the event still happened and people are still hurt and, you know, there's still a life lost. And, you know, all of those things are still happening simultaneously to the fact that my family's celebrating me coming home. And so there's so many layers and so many things that, you know, as a when we look at the subject of incarceration, we don't look at all these layers and all these, you know, all the things that happen as side effects. And, you know, these are the things that happen. And it's about our broken society, our broken communities, our broken family units. And it all comes back to the trauma underneath. You know, the things that happened in my family along the lines were the root of what played out as this criminal behavior, so to speak. And so, you know, looking back at that and seeing that no matter how much healing I did while I was in prison and the groups I did and self-reflection, all those things, oh my God, my family didn't do that. And so all of a sudden I realized that it was, you know, that I was growing and changing, but that I was, it was like the time warp. I got dropped back into the moment that I left because no one took that journey with me from my own family. So it was extremely, I don't know, the guilt and shame is just, you know, something to always, that I think that we always deal with on a daily basis.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. We're talking with a couple of performers, former inmates at York Correctional Institution, about their involvement in a new production called Brave in a New World. It's the latest from the Judy Doran Performance Project. When we come back from the break, we're going to hear more about the support that inmates face or have in prison and then when they leave. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today we're talking about prisoner reentry in the context of Brave in a New World, premiering at the Greater Hartford Academy of the Arts next week, September 15th. Information is on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Joining us in studio now is Deborah Gala, Programs Operation Director at Community Partners in Action. Deborah, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
Before we hear more about your organization, I wanted to play another clip from the performance. Again, Lisa Srams is also in studio with us, and she's an ex-inmate and also performs in Brave in a New World. This clip, Lisa, you highlight one of the challenges ex-offenders face once they're on the outside.
I'm dressed professionally, hair, makeup done, clothes just right. On my way out, I look in the mirror, blow myself a kiss, and say, "You got this, girl. Go get 'em." I meet a woman named Damaris. We shake hands, enter the office, and I sit and wait patiently as she reviews all my extensive qualifications and smile when she speaks on how impressed she is. And then, like music to my ears, "Can you start on Monday?" My joy is short-lived, however. That now familiar bombshell drops. Have you ever been convicted of a felony?
What happens, Lisa?
Well, I didn't get that job, but it's very difficult. It's, you can be so qualified for something, but when that question comes up, you debate whether to check it or not, because some people say, "Have you been convicted in the last 5 years? Have you convicted in the last 7 years?" And you don't want to say no. You want to be honest. But sometimes being honest, it's like a slap in the face, because it's like they're not looking at you. They looked at you and your qualifications, and they went from looking at you and your qualifications to looking at that stigma. And they don't realize that some employers can actually get bonded for hiring ex-offenders. So we could actually be a tax write-off, but you don't realize that, because all you hear is, "Oh, my God, they were in jail. Do I really want them working for me? Are they going to cause problems? Are they going to do this?" And then you have some that will actually sit down in an interview, which I did have recently, and talk to you and not focus on that mistake. So you have, it's a 50-50, but it's just difficult because you could be qualified to work at Aetna, but you have to work at Burger King flipping burgers because you were incarcerated.
How long did it take you to get a job after you were released?
Actually, it didn't take me any time, but it was the point of I actually had a network. One of my closest friends, as well as Deb, because I worked with their program, helped me to go out into the society and find different jobs, placements, you know, go to temp agencies. I went to all of that, but I actually lucked out because one of my closest friends, who was actually released 6 years ago, was working at a restaurant, and I ended up working at that restaurant with her, and I stayed there for a while. But then when you want to transition because you want more, you want more than minimum wage. But it's also difficult for those who haven't been incarcerated to get a position right now. So, but then when you have that mistake on you, it's even harder.
Deborah Gala, you again are with the nonprofit Community Partners in Action. So how are you working with people like Lisa when they're released?
Yeah, Lisa's exactly right. I mean, the stigma is huge for individuals coming out of prison, and that's the reality. We live in a really judgmental society, and having that piece on your record, having that criminal record, is extremely challenging. I mean, that is a reality for so many of our individuals. Training is a big piece of what CPA does, helping individuals get additional training in order to boost up that resume, helping individuals answer that question of the criminal background, and then the reality of working with the employer to help them understand the population that we work with, that anybody that you hire is a risk, and understanding that the individual is working with them and that they're going to have a support system with them when they hire the population that we're working with. But helping the society realize that these are human beings that we're working with.
We interviewed an ex-offender last week, and he said when he got out, he was able to either get a job in a restaurant or working in a warehouse. Are these the employers that are more likely to hire someone that has a prison record, Deborah?
Yes. Without the skills and the training, that is most likely the job that a lot of people are getting.
And how do people who are leaving prison, how do they get connected to nonprofits that support network in their community?
We run, and that's how we got in touch with Judy Dorn's project. We have one program called the Resettlement Program, and that works with individuals prior to release. And for me, that's the biggest piece of a reentry program, is to actually start long before someone gets out of prison and work with them months before they get out, the day they get out, and follow them at least, at the very least, for the year of transition. That's a real solid reentry program. And if we had every individual incarcerated going through that process, for me, that would be really good, solid reentry programming.
Joining us now by phone is Jill Sandor, a clinical social worker at York Correctional Institution. Again, that's Connecticut's women's prison. Jill, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
So just piggybacking off of what Deb said, you know, what work is being done within our prison system to help inmates who are going to be released soon to find a job, to get connected to services they need?
We do have some programs here that are geared towards that. That's the commissioner's main focus, is, you know, reentry. Unfortunately, it's not always accessible to all the women here and not always in a timely manner for them. We see programs like Resettlement Program being one of the more effective programs because they start working with the women prior to release and getting them ready to go home. There is a new building on our minimum side of the prison that is focusing on preparing them to get home, helping them to find jobs, those kinds of things, teaching them to be yoga-trained yoga teachers, those types of things that hopefully will help them be more marketable when they leave here.
You said that not all inmates are connected to these services. Why is that?
Part of it is because some of them need to stay on our maximum security side, and a lot of these opportunities are on our minimum security side. The good thing about, once again, what Deborah Gala was talking about is that they can reach both sides of this prison, which is very helpful.
So when you say max and minimum, so depending on the severity of the crime?
Length of time, the crime that they committed, possible other stipulations that make that they can't go to our East minimum security side.
I wanted to turn back to Robin Cullen again, a performer in Brave in a New World, also had spent some time at York Correctional Institution. What worked for you to get connected to a job once you were released?
The most amazing thing happened. I was able to go back to the job I had prior to being incarcerated. I worked in a health food store, and the woman who owned the store hired me back. But the challenge was transportation, because many of us coming out don't have a vehicle, don't have transportation. And so I had to figure out how to get to work. I had to learn the bus system. I had to totally readjust. And part of my sentence was that I had lost my driving privilege for a year. And so, you know, that challenge alone hinders employment. And so I was very supported with family, by family and by friends and prior employers. So I didn't have a difficult time with that. But I watch women struggle over and over again. And, you know, the piece, we're looking at the piece of getting a job, but there are so many components to that. And, you know, I challenge anybody to just, you know, where you work now, go online and try to figure out, if you had to take a bus to get to your job today, how would you do that? And, you know, that's what we're expecting people do. Oh, just take the bus. But it's, you know, for some people, it's an hour and a half. You miss a bus, you're late for work. You know, so there's so many layers to, you know, to this one component, which is part of surviving on the outside. And so, you know, chicken and the egg, right? Job, transportation, you know, we look at those things, but...
And then you add substance abuse and mental health to it.
Exactly. Exactly. And coping skills and, you know, all those things, that it becomes a challenge for, you know, somebody that didn't have any of these, you know, things happen in their life.
Deb, I wanted to go back to you again. You're with Community Partners in Action, a nonprofit that is helping connect people who are ex-offenders once they're on the outside, not just to employment, but also just other services they may need. Can you talk about, Robin made the comment about, you know, transportation is a big problem. If you can't find a way to get somewhere, how do you get the job? But what are some other real-life challenges that people are facing on the outside?
Yeah, that's a huge one. I would say housing is another big one. And those mental health issues and substance abuse issues are all linked together, the trauma issues. You both spoke about those brilliantly earlier. And, you know, Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor are helping with some of those challenges of getting to work and then providing those basic need support services, which are so critical. Because if you don't have those basic need funding line items to help with those areas when you're talking about education and employment services together, they have to be together, because just getting the job, if you're actively using, you can't be working. If you don't have a place to live, you can't be working.
You mentioned funding line items. So, you know, my next question was about, you know, the state budget crisis. And so we hear often about reform initiatives from the governor's office. But when it comes time to get a balanced budget, I mean, what programs that would help former inmates may not be getting the funding?
Yeah, Connecticut was hit hard, and specifically with the judicial branch and Department of Correction was hit really hard this past fiscal year. And fortunately, CPA has a Department of Labor grant that we run called Train to Work. And we still have funding through that line item that has helped with the employment and training piece. But resettlement specifically was hit extremely hard. We lost the majority of our funding. We're working on getting alternative funding from the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving. But that's one of our biggest reentry programs. And so we're hopeful that we will continue to address these critical issues, because this is a population that, 95% of individuals incarcerated are coming out. And we need to provide solid programming. Both Robin and Lisa talked about taking responsibility, and that's what it's about. Individuals are taking responsibility. I've been in this field for 22 years. I've never met an individual that wanted to live a life of going back and forth in and out of prison. Reducing that recidivism rate is our priority.
And Jill Sandor, a clinical social worker at York Correctional Institution, I wanted to go back to you. What do you hear from inmates who have had time on the outside and because of circumstances, they end up back in prison? What support do they still need to keep that recidivism rate low?
You know, I think everything that everyone has mentioned about trying to find a job, transportation, housing, getting insurance to be able to stay on medications if they do take medications, all of those things impact whether they're going to be successful out there or not. Being able to reach out to people in the outside, Judy's program and Deborah Gala, the work that they do, having them feel connected in the community is so important because a lot of these women make connections here that help them, but we are not here to help them once they go home. They need that continued support when they go home. So anything that allows them to have access to jobs, access to housing, to clothing, all of those needs are really important. And family support is huge. Not all these women here have family support. They don't always have a place to go, and they can't always get reconnected with their children. And those things impact their decisions when they're out there.
We're almost out of time. I want to turn back to Judy Dworin, again, founder and executive and artistic director of the Judy Dworin Performance Project. What do you hope Brave in a New World will do when people see it next week in Greater and Hartford?
Well, I really hope it will open people's minds. It will bring awareness and understanding to some of the issues that we're talking about today. And I think most of all, it will open up the idea that we are all human and that there is this essential humanity that we need to look at these questions through the lens of humanity and the humanness of the story. The stories that people will hear are stories that they won't hear very often and almost never. Some of them are from women that are still on the inside. Many are from women who have been there and are now out, the kids. I think that they will be moved, and in being so moved, we'll think about how we might be able to change things and develop them and make them better than they are.
I want to say thanks to Judy Dworin, also Robin Cullen and Lisa Srams, and Jill Sandor, who joined us by phone, and Deborah Gallo from Community Partners in Action. Thank you so much for your time. We're almost out of time. We're going to go to break, but you can hear more and get more information on our website, wmpr.org/where we live, to find out about Brave in a New World. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Coming up tomorrow, it's been 15 years since the terrorist attacks on 9/11. 15 years. We'll talk to two people personally affected by the tragedy about their lives since. That's tomorrow. Right now, we're going to shift to a story that's been getting a lot of attention here in Connecticut and nationally. And on the phone with us is a reporter from the Danbury News-Times, Dirk Parafort. Dirk, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi. Thank you, Lucy. Good morning.
So the story that we wanted to focus on for the last part of the show is the story of Panna Crom of Danbury. She's a woman that's been serving time at York for manslaughter and the death of her newborn. Tell us about Panna.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I heard Jill talking before about, you know, family support and how huge that is when they get out. And I think that's one thing in Panna's case where, you know, from sentencing up to the clemency hearing yesterday, she's had a large group of, you know, family and friends who've been kind of standing behind her and supporting her this whole time. And I think that probably made a big impact on the outcome of this case to this point.
So you referenced the Connecticut Board of Pardons and Parole. They held a hearing yesterday where they commuted her sentence. So she pled guilty almost 10 years ago to killing her newborn. You know, why did this hearing come up now?
Well, it took about 3 years worth of work on from volunteers on her behalf to get to that point. And her argument was that the sentencing was more punitive than anything else at this point, that the majority of mothers who had similar cases only served about were sentenced to 1.5 to 2 years in prison.
That's interesting. You know, again, she pled guilty to manslaughter. Her sentence was 18 years, but her supporters said that she was treated harshly.
Yeah, well, they said that the sentence was too punitive and that she could do more work on the outside. State's attorney Steve Sedensky, who argued against it, noted that she was originally charged with murder, and when you look at comparative cases in murder, the sentence was appropriate. He did note that she also was up for parole in January 2019 and had preferred to wait until that time, I think.
What's interesting about this case, too, Dirk, is, you know, people want to have sympathy for her because she was a teenager, and again, the circumstances was she hid her pregnancy. She didn't know who to turn to, allegedly, and, you know, she killed her newborn. But the flip side is, you know, she killed a baby. This baby is not alive today. And so, you know, why was 18 years not a suitable sentence?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very difficult case in that respect. Ask that question again. I'm sorry.
Well, again, just the flip side. What have you been hearing in Danbury, the community of Danbury, who may have know her family, the fact that, again, that she did murder her newborn? Why was 18 years not sufficient?
Yeah, well, I mean, Steve Sinensky really went into the horrendous nature of the crime and why he felt it was appropriate, noting that she had flushed the toilet on several occasions. And, of course, the defense noted that, you know, here's a 16-year-old girl who gave birth by herself in a bathroom with no assistance or any knowledge of pregnancy or labor. And, you know, I can only imagine what that would be like for a 16-year-old girl to go through that, having watched my wife go through it three times already. You know, it's a very difficult case, I think, on both sides. I know Sedensky had mentioned that he thought that there were some people who did reach out to help her. There was a teacher and a friend's parent who tried to reach out to her. I know she said she had considered abortion or adoption, but she said that those just didn't seem right for her, which seemed a little odd to me to a certain respect. Mm. So,
can we talk about, is this rare that the Connecticut Board of Pardons and Parole, they commuted her sentence, she'll be released September 30th. Is it rare for this to happen?
Yeah, no, it's extremely rare. I think that's one of the reasons why Steve was so against it at that point. He said in this case they were almost acting more as a sentence review board instead of a clemency board, and he didn't feel that was appropriate in this case. You know, obviously it got a lot of public attention, and there was a lot of volunteers and a lot of family support who worked with Panna over the last 3 years to try and get to this point. Obviously, you know, she also did do a lot of work volunteering, talking with other troubled teens about her experiences, so I think that favored in her behalf also.
And at this hearing, for us, for many of us who've never covered the commutation hearing such as this, any indication from the board members of why they decided this way?
No, actually, the board members made no comments after the hearing. They came out of executive session and they handed down their verdict in the case and just closed the hearing up at that point. So no real comment from them as to why they decided to go in this direction.
And reaction from Panna and her family?
They were just obviously overjoyed. I mean, her parents have been visiting her every Saturday, taking the drive from Bethel, the hour-and-a-half drive up to Niantic every Saturday to visit her for 9 years. And, you know, they just said that they were just happy and thankful to have their girl back and their daughter back.
I want to thank Dick Parafort, a crime reporter for the Danbury News-Times. He covered the state pardons and parole board hearing on Wednesday. When Panna Crom received the news, her prison sentence was commuted. She'll be free from prison later this month after serving nearly 10 of an 18-year sentence for manslaughter in the death of her newborn in 2006. Thank you, Dirk.
Thanks, Lucy. I appreciate it.
The show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Thanks to technical producer Kion Wolf. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening today.